to take a whole 362.
Denise Frederick is a nanny and home attendant who lives in Brooklyn. Stay tuned for more installments of New York in Crisis, WBAI's Coronavirus Diary, and for the latest news and updates on COVID-19.
Good afternoon, WBAI listeners. That last program was a WBAI paid programming, but not to worry, the original programming that usually comes on at 11 from the streets with Bob Law will be back next Saturday from 11 to 12. Time right now is 12 in the afternoon. Good afternoon to all of our listeners. Get ready for your next show, Coping with COVID, with your host, Sri Srinivasan, here on 99.5 FM WBAI New York.
Hello, 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 everyone. Welcome to Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. My name is Sri Srinivasan. It's 82 degrees in New York City. I'm the host of Coping with COVID-19, a helpful, hopeful call-in show. Today is our 19th show, and we're so grateful to everyone who's called in and to all of our guests. Thank you for supporting WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-supported progressive radio, here in New York City and worldwide on WBAI.org. On Coping with COVID-19, we discuss various aspects of the crisis, but we focus on its effects on society's most vulnerable, workers, the poor, the marginalized, and talk to ordinary citizens and experts. We learn together. A little bit about my background. I host daily shows about COVID-19 on my YouTube channel, Srinet, S-R-E-E-N-E-T, and I'm the Marshall Loeb Visiting Professor of Digital Innovation at Stony Brook University and someone who spent 25 years working at iconic New York City institutions. I was the Chief Digital Officer of Columbia, then the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then the city itself working in the basement of City Hall. All three of those New York City icons, like millions of New Yorkers, have been disrupted as never before. Our beloved city became the epicenter of the U.S. crisis and a warning to the rest of the country of what can happen. And then, miraculously, things got better here and horrifyingly got worse everywhere else. We are emerging carefully. We're emerging stronger, but we have a long way to go. On this show, we want to be hopeful and helpful, but we don't pretend everything is fine like someone we know in DC. We want to be clear-eyed and share factual, useful information and stories throughout the show. You can call in and share your thoughts at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877, or email me, Sree, S-R-E-E, at S-R-E-E.net. And you can always tweet me at Sree, S-R-E-E, on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Who's been helpful to you? How have you been helpful to others? Share a story, share a tip, call in now. This is a two-hour show right up to 2 p.m. Eastern time. And for our first hour, we have Professor John Marshall with us. He's an assistant professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwest University. And he has also written a book called Watergate's Legacy and the Press, The Investigative Impulse. Today, he's here to talk to us about the press, the role of the journalism world in what has happened these last 5 months, what's going to happen with about 87 days left to the elections. And so you'll get a chance to ask him questions about the role of the media. And we'll get to talk about it, discuss it, critique it as your questions come up. For our second hour at the 1 p.m. Eastern time, we have Dr. Hafia El-Tahir with us. She's a third-year resident and surgeon at Rutgers University in the department where they do head and neck surgery. She's our medical expert of the day, so if you have medical questions, please wait to our second hour to ask them. She'll be here, and she'll answer your questions. But first, let's start with Professor John Marshall of Northwestern. How are you, sir?
Sri, I'm very happy to be here, especially happy after hearing your opening song of George Harrison singing Here Comes the Sun. That always puts me in a good mood. So thank you for having me on the show.
And it tells you something, John, about how things have changed enough that anyone would even comment on that song. All these days, we know we started playing it at the height of the crisis. We were live right after the lockdown started, and it was in the middle of winter anyway. But New York looked like we were in for a really long haul, as it turned out we are. But we didn't expect to see the sun for a long time. We are now seeing the sun here, just as the rest of the country, as I said, is dealing with this crisis in horrifying ways. So let's start by asking you where you are, how you are, how you're dealing with the crisis. How's your family doing?
Well, thank you for asking. I'm in the Chicago area. Personally, I'm doing fine, but I know that all around things are very difficult for a whole lot of people. And I've certainly known people whose friends and family members have died from COVID. So it's an immense tragedy that really didn't need to happen this way. In the Chicago area, we had a crisis not at the level that New York City had in terms of the number of deaths and the number of hospitalizations, but it was quite serious in March and April. And through a lot of hard work, a lot of sacrifice by a lot of people, a lot of carefulness from a lot of people, our rates started to trend downwards. And in June, our governor, J.B. Pritzker, started to open things up more and more for businesses, for people to go out and be together. But then, unfortunately, the rates have started to rise again here. We were down to a positivity rate from testing of about 2.4% in around early to mid-June. And now it's up around 5% or so and continuing to climb, and the number of cases are going up with it. And then, the number of deaths had gone down tremendously to maybe like 10 or 12 a day, which is 10 or 12 too many, but it's way better than the, 100 to 200 that we had at one point. But now the death rates are starting to climb too. So it's very disturbing what's happening here. And even so, more so what's happening in a lot of other places in the country where the death rates and the positivity rates are in caseloads are much higher.
And it's so sad to think about, as you said, that it didn't need to be like this. And we'll get into that in just a minute. Since we are talking about Chicago, the president has made Chicago part of his reelection campaign, clearly.
Yes.
And pointing out the gun violence and the shootings. Sitting here in New York, where we have our own share of an uptick in crime, if you wouldn't mind, and we hadn't planned to talk about this, but since we're talking about Chicago, can you just explain what is happening with crime there as far as you can, as far as you understand it, and why has this been a problem even before the pandemic, unlike almost any other big city, including big cities that had problems much worse than Chicago in the old days?
Well, sure. I don't want to pretend to be an expert criminologist, but I certainly, follow the news and the headlines and try to talk with experts. First of all, clear up a sort of misconception. While the total number of murders is extremely high in Chicago, as are shootings, the rate per capita per person in Chicago is actually, last time I looked, we weren't even in the top 20 in terms of cities. We're a very large city, so the numbers are big and are deeply disturbing. But to say that it's just a Chicago problem, I think kind of distorts the picture that in a lot of other cities, large and small, there are also terrible and problems with murders and shootings. But to get at your question, crime rates had overall been going down in Chicago. And after a lot of hard work, the murder rates had been going down as well. Not nearly to the level that anybody would want, but they were trending in the right direction. A few years ago, state of Illinois had a budget stalemate under the former governor, Republican governor, Democratic legislature. They couldn't agree on a budget. And spending on social services, on programs like job programs for teens, after school programs, mental health services were completely frozen and actually worse than frozen, done away with for like close to a year. And that had a very detrimental effect, and crime rates went shooting up afterwards. And then, since then, again, the rates started to go down again. But then since the pandemic, we've seen an alarming spike here. And a lot of theories about why that's happening. Frustrations, I think, of people just being cooped up inside. And then finally with warmer weather, and loosening of restrictions, things that have been pent up, feuds that have been going on between different gangs burst out into the open. Some folks say that because of the protests against police violence, that some of the police are not going out into the communities to the extent that they once did, that might be a contributing factor too. And it's probably going to take some years of study to figure out like really what have been the biggest factors in that, but those are some of the elements that are going on. And then the overall problem is, as in a lot of cities, deep and ongoing systemic inequalities and racism. So a lack of services to many parts of the city where people of color live, lack of good healthcare, lack of good schools, lack of jobs, lack of good mental health services, and so on. And that's been going on for decades. So that's probably the underlying condition that's contributed to the most.
Thank you for laying that out so clearly. In all your, all your diagnosis and your explanation, I didn't hear that there was an urgent need for the federal government to send in troops.
No, absolutely. I think there's very few people in Chicago who would want that. The police union chief, who's a strong ally of President Trump, has called for federal forces to come in. But outside of that, there's not a lot of people who think that's a good idea. Nobody likes an occupying force in their neighborhood. And especially one, a heavily militarized force is just going to antagonize people and make them feel even more that the government isn't on their side. And so the mayor on down thinks it's a bad idea having federal troops trying to patrol our streets.
And this ties back to your expertise. You know, the press, the way they cover this topic, the topic of the pandemic, all of that is some, in many cases contributes to the confusion and what is actually happening on the ground. And we will talk about that also in just a minute. We're with John Marshall, J-O-N Marshall, in case
That's
you're Googling
right.
him. Please check him out. And his Twitter handle is fabulous. It's Marshall Report, at Marshall Report, Marshall with two L's. And I asked him if Marshall Plan was not available. And he's, of course, a journalist, so he went with Marshall Report, which I like also. And please do connect with him and follow him. And please send us your questions about how you think the media has been doing. Of course, we should start, John, by saying there isn't such a thing as the media.
Oh, that's absolutely right. I'm glad you made that point. People talk about the media does this, the media does that. The media ranges from everything to you and I having this conversation here, to the broadcast networks, to major newspapers, to podcasters, to any website that out there that puts out any sort of information. You or I or any of our listeners posting something on Facebook or on Twitter or on a Reddit or Instagram or any sort of social media, that's media. And so when people criticize the media or praise the media. I think it's important to try to drill down and make clear exactly what media they're talking about.
And so what is your assessment of how the media in all its shapes and sizes has done during the pandemic? When I look at America's outcomes are worse than any country in the world, any measure you look at it, we see it as a failure. I see it as a failure of leadership. I see it as a failure of technology, systems, processes, but I also see the media as having failed, or elements of the media having failed.
I think that's right. I think definitely elements of the media. There have been some examples, I think, of some great reporting that's been done, some really excellent journalism here and there. That's a little bit more than here and there. You know, there's some people who really have, I think, really done a sustained effort reporting on the personal impact from COVID, doctors and nurses struggling, communities that are struggling, particularly communities of color, and also looking at overall trends and reporting on the president's lack of leadership on this issue. There's been some excellent reporting being done. But on the whole, because we live in such a fractured media environment right now, and people are getting information or misinformation from thousands, if not millions, of different sources, it's, I think, very difficult for a lot of folks to try to get a clear picture of what's happening. And because so much of the media now has become hyper-partisan, some outlets, some channels of media are more interested in trying to prove their narrative of what's happening, whether that narrative is true or not, than actually looking clear-eyed at the facts and trying to give people a very accurate picture of what's happening. And so I think our polarized media environment now has contributed to a polarized response to the pandemic, where large portions of the population aren't taking it seriously, or large portions of the population are believing in cures that are not really cures, or believing that not wearing a mask is essential, or believing that it's a hoax perpetrated by Democrats and city dwellers and the media, rather than a pandemic that's really real and highly dangerous.
And here we are with the outcome of all
which is why
that.
Your show is so valuable in trying to really address it.
Thank you. And this is why we need great guests like you who are here. Folks, please call in and talk to John Marshall. He's a professor at Northwestern at the famed Medill School of Journalism. And he is here to answer questions. 212-209-2877. How do you think the press has been doing overall? If you're listening and would like, you have a question, specific channels. And one of the things that we hear, John, is that there is a feeling that partisanship has become the norm. And therefore, because there are organizations that are proudly partisan, such as Fox, Breitbart, MSNBC on some of their opinion shows, then everybody gets tainted with that. In England, it's a little different, where people, press, especially newspapers, had a tradition of being partisan. But in America, at least it felt for several decades that wasn't the case. Can you help us sort that out a little bit? And then we'll talk about the elections.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm glad you're giving it an international perspective. Yeah, the U.S. media the U.S. system of the press historically is different from most other countries. There's some countries that are authoritarian models where the government controls everything. As you mentioned, there's a proud tradition in Europe and some other places of a press that's doesn't try to pretend to be objective, but says, you know, this is our point of view, and these are the facts that fit with our point of view, and we're going to make conclusions based on it. And also, you mentioned Great Britain, and they also have the model of the BBC, which people pay when they buy a TV set. They pay a tax that goes towards funding the BBC, and it presents a news that, in my mind, is pretty comprehensive, and I think has a wide level of trust in Great Britain And I'm not sure if there is any media outlet, any news outlet in the United States that has that same sort of level of trust. I think there's also a difference between partisan and advocacy media, which I think has a role, and media that says we're going to follow the facts, we're going to gather the evidence, and then we're going to make some conclusions based on that evidence. And I think the U.S. traditional press, the mainstream press, is sometimes very reluctant to make conclusions. Instead, we have the, I think it's, you know, Jay Rosen, I think at NYU coined the term, the view from nowhere, where reporters will just present information, but not try to give it any sort of perspective, in U.S., in a lot of U.S. media. And I think by doing so with this sort of he said, she said, method of presenting the news, it's hard for the audience to try to put the pieces together and try to see the bigger picture. And I think we have a situation now with the pandemic and leading up to our elections where the big picture is that we are in a highly dangerous time in terms of the pandemic. And there's been a complete, or nearly complete, I should say, lack of leadership at the top in addressing that. And I think every story needs to make that clear. And approaching the election, I think we're also approaching a highly dangerous time where there are, need to be careful how I phrase this, but I think there are moves, you know, towards a fascistic way of handling things. And there's strands of that all over the place. And I think the press, the media, shouldn't be afraid of saying in its stories that we're on, there's a lot of things that are leading us towards a very dangerous path in terms of the country moving step by step towards a fascistic model.
That is such an important point and something I will want to get back to, but we have callers on hold and we don't want to keep them waiting. Folks, you are listening to Coping with COVID-19. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan, and we're on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and worldwide on WBAI.org. Please tweet us at Sri, S-R-E-E, at WBAI, and the hashtag WBAISREE. Please call in 212-209-2877. Let's go to our first caller. You're on the air on WBAI. Tell us your name and where you're calling from, please.
Steve from Jackson Heights, Queens.
Hi, thank you for joining us. Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Yes, sir. If you can't hear me, let me know, or maybe it's the phone. Yes, Sri, great show as always. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, so is the guest taking the position that in favor of what has been termed advocacy journalism, that is that journalism should no longer be objective, at least in the news sections, and that the news section should be take a point of view, so that therefore not only is the editorial section taking a point of view, but that the news section will take a point of view, and that objectivity will no longer be the goal of the news section and no longer taught that way in journalism schools?
That's a great question. Thanks, Steve, for asking that. And it's one I discuss a lot with my students. And one I think sort of my thoughts on have sort of changed through the years. First of all, there's a long tradition of advocacy journalism in the United States and elsewhere. Before the Civil War, there was the abolitionist press, which advocated very strongly against the abolishment of slavery, and wrote in great detail about the brutality and the rapes and the murders. The selling of children that slavery involved, which the main press at that time didn't write about or barely wrote about. And I think looking back historically, we would say it was that advocacy abolitionist press that actually followed the evidence more, gathered the facts more, and they reached conclusions based on it and said, you know, this is evil. The sort of objective style of journalism that really kind of became the norm in the United States in the 20th century, starting around 1910s, 1920s, through really most of the 20th century, was a style would say, quote, one leader, quote, another leader with the opposite view, quote, one expert, then find another expert, lay it all out there, let the reader or viewer decide. And I think there is some value to that. But what I like to think about objectivity is more like the scientific method, where scientists will may have a hypothesis about what's going on, will gather evidence, will test it, will do a broader study, test it again, and then reach a conclusion based on it. And so I think an objective method follows the facts where they go, reports thoroughly, looks at different sides of an issue, and then balances it in terms of where the preponderance of evidence is. And if the preponderance of evidence says one thing, then reach that conclusion. And I think climate change is the perfect example of that. For years, the U.S. press wrote articles saying many scientists believe that climate change is a great danger, but here's some other scientists we found who says it's not a danger, and here's another politician who says it's not dangerous, and we'll leave it at that. And I think that ended up presenting really actually a distorted view of reality, and I don't think was a service to its readers. So there may be some issues where you can't really draw a conclusion because the evidence is unclear, but if the evidence does show a strong preponderance towards a conclusion, then I think journalists should say it. And I also feel like within my school, that may be a controversial position to take, and in the broader media world, that might be a controversial position to take. But I think this notion that every side is equally valid is really not serving it's serving our audience as well.
Steve, I don't know if you're still with us, Steve. Okay, he may have dropped off, but John, that is a question, you know, what your answer, which I think is in the right direction, will get people riled up because they believe that there is such a thing as objectivity, that you can do it, you can play it down the middle, and you got to give everybody equal time. I mean, even the equal time concept actually exists in the way the FCC and others look at media.
Well, I think another good example is coverage of COVID, where we have many experts saying people should wear masks when they're out with other people, and then others, you know, the president sometimes yes, sometimes no, says you know, don't wear a mask or don't bother. There are people in the right wing who say, you know, masks are an infringement on my liberty and they don't work anyhow. And I think responsible journalism puts the preponderance on saying wear a mask, because that's where the science and the epidemiologists and the doctors say is necessary.
And that's why I think journalists should be careful about how they think about this. I mean, one of the things we've also talked about, I did an interview with the former opinion page editor of the New York Times. Of course, that's supposed to be opinion, but she said that the words you use even matter, right? So if it had been called, instead of being called climate change, it was called global warming. That's what, you know, it was called global warming for all these years. If 30 years we had been hearing climate change and global warming, then every time it was cold, partisans like the president couldn't say, oh, what global warming, right? So we are now seeing some news organizations calling it a climate emergency. And that's where they are saying we need to pay attention rather than stick to some old rules that may or may not work in this current context.
Well, I agree. Right. I think it should be called a crisis because it is.
But even that is political. To call it a crisis is political in this day and age, and that's the world we've ended up in. Folks, right. You're listening to John Marshall, Professor John Marshall, who is at Marshall Report on Twitter. And we are talking about the role of the press in coverage of COVID. His expertise is the press, and he is working on a book on the press and the elections. And we'll come to that after we talk to our next guest, our next caller, who is on the line right now. You're on the air on WBAI. Please tell us where you're calling from and your name, please.
Hi, this is George from Hazlitt, New Jersey. How are you?
Good to have you. Sure. Please speak up. We'd love to hear your question.
All right. I'm a little confused. You say we should be relying on the media to give us answers, and they should, you know, be straightforward, this, that. We have to rely on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to tell us that Fauci and the CDC and Bill Gates are all heavily invested in these vaccines and all these orders of masks and everything else. And the other thing is why don't we hear about the other countries that are not wearing masks, not social distancing, not getting sick, and where are all the sick people in the jails and prisons? Because if it was a real pandemic, the jails would be dying. And anybody who knows anything about viruses knows there's cesspools and knows that everybody would bring them in from outside, and it would be a rampant thing. So it is a hoax created by Bill Gates.
Sorry, we're going to cut you off, Giovanni, if you wouldn't mind, please, cutting off our guest, our speaker there, caller. We do not want to talk about hoaxes when we know this is not a hoax. This is an example of what I was talking about, John, that people think nothing's happening in jail, nothing's happening in prisons. That is not the case here. There are plenty of places on the internet for people to make those statements, but people listen and they take away that this is true. One of the reasons why Paul Manafort was let out was so that to not get sick. And we had an expert from the prison system talking about prisons on the show a few weeks ago about how rampant it is. It's spreading like wildfire inside prisons. So to say this is a hoax, that's where I draw the line on this show. John, you may have been surprised that I cut him off. Your thoughts?
Well, I think the caller's question is really a reflection of sort of the fragmented media world we live in today, because there are numerous outlets out there, talk radio, a lot of internet sites, who are spreading the kind of sort of conspiracy theories that he was talking about, and are still denying that COVID is real. And as you said, some of the biggest hotspots where death rates have been highest are communities where there are prisons. I think you're probably right to cut them off. It's your show. You can decide how to handle it. But I fear that, you know, the view that he was expressing, unfortunately, is shared by a large percentage, but there's a definite percentage of the population that believes that. And the way our media world is structured now contributes to that.
And just to think about being so convinced that this is not a crisis, to call into a radio station, right, and make that point. I mean, that's how strongly you believe it. It's not like you have a doubt. You believe it, and the people he's quoting in you know, about vaccines for a second, let's talk about that. Everyone's hoping that a vaccine comes out. The president has declared it'll be here before the elections, which is another point. But the fact is, even if you get the vaccine, the efficacy of vaccines and their nature has been so poisoned by everyone, starting with the president, Jenny McCarthy, but also a name he mentioned, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., mm-hmm, right? And right. That's where an educated man, obviously, whose heart in many things is in the right place. I've seen him, what he's done in cleaning up Hudson River and so much more, but could poison the entire program that we want to do, get people out there and safe. And the vaccine may not be used because of this. That's the world we're living in now. And I think journalists and others, by not calling it out early enough and calling out people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I mean, I think about his father and what he would say, the chaos that's going to cause and has already caused in this world. Americans' outcomes in everything from COVID to measles is worse than everybody because of misinformation and disinformation. How are you thinking about this?
I think to a large extent, we're living in Rush Limbaugh's world right now, or at least a portion of our population is. Let me explain. And the end of Ronald Reagan's.
I'm going to cut you off, John.
the end of Ronald Reagan's term, he ended what was known as the Fairness Doctrine, which was that broadcast media, if they presented a Democratic view, then they also had to present a Republican view. Had to try to create some kind of balance and try to serve the public. There was a mandate to serve the public. That was done away with at the end of Reagan's term. He vetoed a bill by Congress that would have kept that going, and that opened the door wide for radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh. And eventually Fox News, and then after that MSNBC, to be on the airwaves in a very partisan way. And, Limbaugh has, since the 80s, since the 90s, has been expressing a point of view that says, don't trust scientists. They're all corrupt, and they're trying to spread this global warming hoax. Don't trust government. Ever. Don't trust people who live in cities because they're not real Americans. Certainly don't trust the mainstream media for anything. And Limbaugh, was sort of at the extreme end of things when he came out, but really no longer. He's kind of, when you listen to some of the other folks out there on talk radio and on Breitbart, other websites, he's almost kind of become in the middle of the right-wing sphere, but it's all has a huge emphasis on don't trust the institutions that are kind of based on knowledge and fact-finding, scientists, journalists, government agencies, and it's real people like them who really know the truth. And I think that's created a dangerous situation for us.
And a situation that has, again, no, use the word poisoned, how people look at all media because of that. How did Reagan know that that would work, that this would set off this enormous, would break the dam and a lot of it in the favor of his side of the political argument? How did he know that? And why did the Democrats not start up their own Rush Limbaughs and folks like that?
Great question. It's really kind of a two-part question. How did Reagan know? I'm not sure if he knew it would unleash this. There had been, since starting at the end of World War II, a group of conservatives got together, and they hated the New Deal. They hated Franklin Roosevelt. They hated the idea of the United Nations. And they argued that the whole political establishment and the whole media were against them and were unfair to them. And they started some publications like Human Events and National Review, which were conservative publications, and started a whole host of radio programs, as well as some book publishing, that expressed that worldview. They, for a while, kind of flew under the radar, even though there was the Fairness Doctrine. The Federal Communications Commission didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. Then under John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Democratic administrations started to become much more aware of it and were alarmed by it. And a scholar named Nicole Hemmer has done some excellent research on this. They started to have an FCC that was much more stringent on partisan broadcasting. So Reagan was aware of that, and he was aware that conservatives were unhappy that the fairness doctrine was being enforced, and their ideology was against really any kind of government regulation. So that's what really, I think, prompted Reagan to do away with the fairness doctrine. And then there was a second part of your question. I'm sorry, I forgot.
No, why is the right been so much more successful?
Oh, yes.
With all of this compared to radio and TV and blogs and Twitter and Reddit and social media and.
I think conservatives were really pretty much smarter than the liberals and the left about this. Liberals and lefts were sort of content to debate on the editorial pages of the New York Times and Washington Post, or the Nation magazine, or the New Republic, which was sometimes liberal at least back then, and really didn't understand the power of radio specifically to reach people. And I think that's partly because talk radio was most popular in less populated areas and rural areas where people have to drive long distances and are keeping themselves company with the radio. And those areas tend to be more conservative. So talk radio really took hold strongly in those areas, where in more urban areas, where liberals and people on the left tended to congregate more, they were paying more attention to what was going on in the print media, where there were big city newspapers. The largest radio company in the nation, Clear Channel, which became iHeart, had a strong conservative leaning, and they promoted these talk shows, financed them well. And then Sinclair, the largest owner of local television stations around the country, also had a strongly conservative bent, and they promoted that as well. Liberals, progressives, Democrats really paid a whole lot less attention to it, and I think that's been probably to their detriment.
So let's just think about that for a second. Everyone says the media is liberal, but the most influential of the way that people get much of their information in many cases has had conservative background.
The whole notion that the media is liberal is really shaky, and has been for a long time. At the time, after the end of World War II, when these groups were forming and they were complaining about the liberal media, the biggest newspaper chain at the time was controlled by William Randolph Hearst, who hated Franklin Roosevelt, and his newspapers very vehemently and his magazines very vehemently opposed Roosevelt. Same with Time magazine, not quite as vehement as Hearst, but strongly Republican, was very opposed to the New Deal. Largest newspaper in the country at that time was the Chicago Tribune, run by Colonel McCormick, who absolutely despised Roosevelt, and didn't just editorialize against Roosevelt, but his news pages were full of attacks against Roosevelt. So sort of the idea that there was this liberal media establishment that these conservatives had this grievance against, even when they formed, wasn't really based in reality. And there's been a lot of surveys done showing that reporters tend to lean liberal, and I think that's accurate. Other surveys show that editors tend to be somewhat middle of the road. And when you get to the ownership of most of the media outlets, it really tends to trend conservative. And some of the most well-known newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, editorially tend to be very liberal, but the Wall Street Journal, another of the largest newspapers, is definitely not liberal. Most of the newspaper chains are owned by companies that are corporations that have conservative interest. And talk radio, as I mentioned before, and much of broadcast TV are run by people with strong conservative leanings. So I think it's really much more of a mixed bag than saying that it's a liberal-controlled media. I just don't think that's accurate.
Thank you so much, John. And we have about another 15 minutes, maybe a little less with you. We have one more caller who we'll have time for. Let's bring the caller on the air. Tell us where you're calling from and your name, please.
I'm up in Harrison, West Harrison, in the dark with no power. I have one question about students returning to the classroom, but I'd like to make the observation that between a couple of days ago and tomorrow, 75 years ago, we Americans wiped out as many Japanese in two blinks of an eye on two targets of no military value as 170,000 dead Americans who died of who knows what combination of comorbidities, okay? If these Americans have died, I think it's a clearing of due bills. Now, the professor said that he believes in the scientific method, and last week your doctor said science is iterative. Iterative to me says it makes mistakes and it corrects. The scientific method involves trial and error, but I find when I call three, and you know who I am, I have one question about education and I'll get right to it. If you're unwilling to, quote, believe the science, you are giving misinformation. Now, how would you test a hypothesis unless you didn't believe it? Now, that's not my question, okay? Professor, I'd like to ask you, if certain parents who are hypersensitive decide to hold back their children from returning to the classroom, should the overwhelming majority of students returning to the classroom, and de Blasio says it's 75% to 80% in New York City, should they be forced to wait for their classroom-deprived peers to catch up once the, quote, panic is over in November or spring, or should those students be left back? I'd like to ask you that question, Professor. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I hope you get your power back soon. I'm here in Chicago. I don't know the specifics of what's going on with the New York schools, and I really don't have an opinion about what decision the school districts or the parents should make. That's, I think, up to the New Yorkers. So I don't have a viewpoint on that.
What is happening, John, with your own at Northwestern? What is happening? Are you going to be teaching in person? How do you feel? You have kids that are college age-ish, right? So how are you handling all of this?
Right, so I will be teaching one of my classes remotely because some of our students are staying remote, and they'll be reporting in the communities where they live. And I'll be teaching one class that's called a hybrid, which I think a lot of schools are doing, where a lot of the sessions will be done remotely, either synchronously, where I'm online with the students at the same time, or because sometimes the students, we have some international students or in time zones where they can't be online with me at the same time. I'll record some things. We'll talk through discussion boards. We'll have individual sessions. But we'll also have some meetings in person for the students who can be there, socially distant, with masks on. And I'll meet with small groups of students at a time, so we don't have a large group of students in a small classroom.
And what are Chicago rules that you know of? I mean, I know you don't live in the city, but you're certainly hearing the news.
You know, Chicago public schools just announced this week that they're going to be all remotely, done remotely. And different suburban school districts are making different decisions on that. The Catholic schools are at this point, or at least as of this morning, are still planning to do in-person classes. So it's kind of a split decision here.
And one of the things I guess will happen is that these schools may, we've seen already in some states, they are already open and they're already having trouble, already cases and quarantining and all of that's going on.
Yeah, and I think, as the caller said, it's iterative. You go with the best knowledge you have at this time. But as the scientific method, as he said, you get new data, you get new information, and sometimes you just adjust accordingly. And certainly, the news media, if they get information and that shows that something they did before was incorrect, at least responsible media will run a correction on that. And so that's very important to do.
Well, in the few minutes we have left, tell us about your book you're working on and your promise that you will come back when the book is published.
I'll be delighted to come back, Sri, especially if you play the Beatles for me one more time. Then my book is titled Clash, Presidents in the Press in Times of Crisis. So it looks at several different presidencies throughout American history and the relationship between those presidents and the media world at the time, and what forces and trends came to play during those presidencies that will help us understand what's going on now with the current administration and President Trump's relationship with the press. And the book will say, in some ways, we're living in unprecedented times in terms of the relationship with the press, but actually there are many different precedents throughout history for at least some aspects of what is going on now between President Trump and the media. There have been
So when people might feel there's never, you know, enemy of the press and terms like that, we know Nixon used verbiage like that, but not publicly again and again in this way. Where do you, you're saying there are, this echoes the past, but you're not saying there was ever a case when it was this bad.
Well, I think if you look at the presidency of John Adams, they passed a law called the Alien and Sedition Act that allowed the government to throw writers and editors in jail if they wrote something that was disparaging of the president or the government. And dozens of writers and editors were thrown in jail under the Adams administration. I'll just give you one quick example of a gentleman named Luther Baldwin, who was a Revolutionary War veteran, was a tugboat captain, and he was drinking apparently pretty heavily in a tavern in New Jersey when the president Adams came by in his I was going to say motorcade, but it wasn't a motorcade then. It was a in the chariots and wagons, and they were shooting off cannons in honor of the president. And Luther Baldwin says, I said something to the effect of, "I hope one of those cannonballs hits him in his arse." And the tavern keeper, who was a fan of President Adams, overheard that and told prosecutors, and they actually threw Luther Baldwin in jail for his comment about what he hoped the cannonball would do. So that those were those times where even uttering something that was disparaging of the president could end up getting you in jail. So I think in some ways, as bad as things are now, there have been elements in the past that have been just as dangerous.
Thank you. We have just another couple of minutes, and we will be joined by Dr. Hafia El-Tahir, who is a expert on, she's a surgeon and a medical expert. She will talk to us about what's happening in New Jersey as well as the New York City area. But we have a few minutes more with John while we wait for her. So, John, if you wouldn't mind just sticking around for a couple more minutes. I can't play any more Beatles, but we've got some B.B. King coming your way.
Oh, so almost we'll as good, yeah.
We'll have to bribe you with that. And so the my question for you is, what should we be looking for as an informed group of people? How do we make sure we have the right information? What are the trends we should be looking for? And what's going to happen in the next 87 days?
Oh, that's a huge question, Sri. What should we be looking for? It's a hard environment in terms of the media for the public to really try to sort through things. I encourage people to look for information that's current. If someone's passing something along on social media, how old is it? I frequently see things that were actually written like 4 or 5 years ago that people think is still current that's being shared on social media. Is the post that you're sharing actually quoting data that links to legitimate sources of information? Does it have that data or that information, that evidence near the top of the story, or is the top of the story a bunch of taunts or insults or tirades that's just trying to evoke one point of view? What's going to happen in the next less than 3 months until the election? I think it's going to be the news media needs to be aware that this is probably not going to be a normal election, that all the standards that we are used to are being challenged, and are going to have to be really doing more investigative reporting about what's going on with voting rights, what's going on with disinformation from foreign entities, what's going on with efforts to stop mail-in balloting, and really try to present a clear picture to the public, an overall clear picture of what's happening, because it's easy to get bogged down in the details, but we need to, the media needs to make clear that this is not going to be likely a normal election.
And I think that's clear for sure. I laugh because otherwise I'll be crying. In terms of who has the responsibility here, journalists or consumers?
Oh, both. Journalists definitely, that's the job we're paid to do. We need to do our very best to be accurate and present information clearly. But it's also, the public, if people care about democracy, they need to care about what they're listening to, what they're reading, and what they're sharing. And it takes, I think, more effort than it used to try to sort through what's out there. But I feel like it's an obligation for us as citizens to really try to do our best to do that.
Thank you. Our guest has been John Marshall. Professor Marshall is at Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for being here. Please look for his book that'll come out next year. But in the meantime, follow him at Marshall Report, MARSHALL Report on Twitter. Thank you very much. We wish you the very best with the reopening of classes and with your research and that book deadline.
Thank you very much, Sri. I really appreciate you having me on the show. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you. And folks, we are going to be joined by Dr. Hafia El-Tahir in just a few minutes, but we're going to take a break, reset, give you a chance to listen to some B.B. King.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble, stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now. Stand by me. Stand by me. Thank you.
Hello, folks. You were just listening to Stand By Me by the great Ben E. King and his classic hit. It's 1 p.m. in New York City, 1 p.m. Eastern. Thank you for being with us. We have another hour of our show, Coping with COVID-19. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan, and I'm honored to convene this weekly conversation around all things to do with COVID-19. That song says it all. We have to stand by each other at this time. We'd never have made it this far without each other's support. I'm so proud of what we've achieved in the New York City area, but we have a long way to go. This hour is our medical hour, and we're going to be talking to Dr. Hafia El-Tahir. She's a resident and surgeon at the Rutgers University department where they do head and neck surgery. We've got a doctor on the show now, so you can ask your medical questions. We hope you will join us and ask your questions. Our phone number is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. You can always tweet me at Sree, S-R-E-E, at WBAI, and the hashtag WBAI-S-R-E-E. Number again is 212-209-2877. Let me first say hello to Dr. El-Tahir. How are you, ma'am?
Hello, I'm fine. How about yourself?
Thank you for being here. I first want to apologize for not saying the name of your department because I was too afraid I would get it wrong.
No, you said it exactly right. And thank you for having me.
But the technical name is much more complicated, isn't it?
Oh, otolaryngology?
Yes.
Yes.
So what does that mean, I can't do it. So you'll have to say it for me.
So it's technically supposed to be otorhinolaryngology, but the name was shortened because it's so long. But oto is for ear, and rhinology is nose. I'm sorry. Rhinology is nose, but laryngology is the throat. So ear, nose, throat.
So instead of saying ENT, this was the shorter version. So I can't, yes. Thank God somebody decided to drop the word rhino from that and make it a little easier. But
that's
the easiest part of your job is saying that, because you're incredible. Well, what you do when we've been in touch, you're writing to us after surgery, before surgery, working the weekends. So I'm so grateful that you would spare your time with us. And I know you do this because you want to help people. You do that every day in the operating room, but you also want to make sure there's good information out there. So let me start with our first question always is, how are you? Where are you? How's your family doing through the pandemic?
Yes, I'm doing well, thankfully. And the same for my family. Thank you for asking. I definitely keep in touch with them on a regular basis and make sure that they're feeling okay. They're not having any symptoms. And, you know, always warn them that if they do, to make sure to call me, let me know. But then, of course, go and get tested. So I've been very fortunate. My family and myself, we've been fortunate and blessed to have all remained healthy during this pandemic. And I'm hoping that, you know, it stays that way. And hope the same for your family as well.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, we're locked down here. My producer is my 17-year-old son, and I can tell you, apart from getting sick, of course, there's probably nothing worse than turning 17 with your parents in lockdown.
Oh, but you said he did get sick or not?
No, he did not get sick.
Okay, good.
So, you know, when I say this is the worst thing that can happen, obviously lots of worse things can happen, but he and his twin sister we're blessed that we've made it this far. And this is what we keep saying. We've made it 150 days. Let's just keep going.
Yes.
We can't afford to get sick. Folks, if you have medical questions, please call in and talk to the doctor. We'd love to hear from you. But let's first hear the doctor's own story. She has an unusual background, and we're just lucky to have her here with us and sharing her story. Go ahead, Doc.
Yeah, so I'm originally from down south. Birmingham, Alabama is where I was born and raised, and pretty much completed all of my schooling and education there in the state of Alabama. But then after graduating medical school and matching into ENT, I arrived here in New Jersey, where I've now been for over 2 years. I've just started. I began my third year of residency, and I really do enjoy being in the Northeast. It's very different. A great experience. And, you know, now I've been met with the challenges of dealing with COVID-19, as many people have, but also working on the front lines. And, you know, I matched into ENT, head and neck surgery. And, you know, when you match into residency, you anticipate that that's pretty much going to be your main focus. And with the pandemic, I found, you know, myself helping out in the ICU and in the COVID ward, because there was such a shortage of physicians and other medical personnel that were able to assist. So I did participate in helping out. And fortunately, now that things have gotten better and our numbers have decreased significantly in the hospitals, now our department has pulled us out of those units, and now we're back primarily working in our specialty, our field, which is ENT, and helping patients in the way that we have in the past. But also a little twist to that is that we're dealing with a lot of patients that have had, you know, complications from COVID, have survived, but, you know, again, have complications that we're now able to help them out with. So that's something interesting.
And what was it like to work on this in these areas where you were not as, you know, that was not where your training was, but of course you understood and you had a role to play?
It was, you know, it was very stressful. And also I had moments where, you know, being in the COVID ward was very depressing, especially seeing so many people suffer and have such a hard time getting through it, and knowing that their families could not be there for them because we weren't allowing people and visitors into the hospital. So many people were suffering, and unfortunately, even people, you know, passed away pretty much alone. So, and, you know, that was very hurtful to see, but also very stressful because, again, you know, this isn't anything anyone anticipated. And so now you're kind of having to switch gears. You're used to coming to work and seeing patients that have primarily issues, you know, within your field that you're practicing within, and also operating on those sort of patients. And now you're kind of looking at the entire body and all these different complications that someone with this virus develop. So it was very challenging. I do have an appreciation for internists and people that, you know, are in primary care, because this is something that they pretty much deal with on a regular basis. And, you know, for me, I don't. So I learned a lot. But I do hope that, you know, we don't go back to that place again, that the numbers remain low and hopefully completely go away. And, you know, no one's having to be redeployed to the COVID ward.
And that is really, I think, part of why we're all here, to tell people not to take the foot off the gas, right? Like, we've got to continue to be careful and to continue to pay attention. Otherwise, we could be right back where we started. Look at California. They locked down before us and they were doing really well. I mean, they're doing really badly, and then they could have done well as we have. Again, we're not out of the woods, or remember, every death has been terrible and we continue to have them, but not at the rates before. But then they rushed to reopen, and now look at California, as bad as some of these other states. And it's so sad to see it. Let me ask you, Doc, about your own background in terms of becoming an ENT doctor. Did you know this is what you wanted to do?
No, actually, it's pretty funny. After graduating from the University of Alabama, completing my undergraduate degree, I actually worked in banking for 4 years. And I always knew prior to, like, when I was in undergrad and on the pre-med track, that ultimately my goal at some point was to become a doctor. But then I had different family things that came up, and originally my plan went from sitting out 1 year and kind of working and being there for family to it turned into, you know, 4 years. But I got to a point where I was like, you know, this is not what I want to do. This isn't something that makes me happy. So I need to go ahead and apply. So when I applied for medical school, I really just thought that I would either do something in primary care, like pediatrics. And then I even entertained the idea of actually becoming an OBGYN. But after I completed my first year of medical school, during that summer, my plan was to go to Sudan and visit my family there. Things kind of fell through and didn't work out. And one of my clients who I had when I worked for the bank was an ENT. And so when he knew that I was accepted into medical school, he told me, if you ever need anything, feel free to reach out to me and I'd be more than happy to help. So I contacted him and I said, hi, you know, I'm kind of in the situation where I have these, you know, a couple of months of free time and I really want to utilize my time as much as possible to learn, you know, and experience something that I haven't experienced before. And he welcomed me. So I spent a couple of months with him. And honestly, after the first week, I was like, this is for me. I can totally see myself doing this for the rest of my life. This is, you know, really awesome. And it was at that point that I knew that I wanted to pursue ENT and really nothing else. That was my main goal. So I worked really hard and kept, you know, my eye on that one thing. And fortunately, it all worked out.
I'm sure, like many immigrant families, they were thrilled that you were becoming a doctor.
Oh, yes. 100%. Because especially in Sudan, like in a lot of other countries, it's, you know, the goal is for your kids to grow up and become either a doctor or an engineer. And I am pretty blessed that, like, I developed that sort of aspiration on my own. I wasn't pressured into doing it, but it's something that I kind of, you know, I developed that aspiration and went for it, and it all worked out, and I have absolutely no regrets.
And tell us what it was like coming from Alabama to New York and New Jersey, and what's the difference in kind of lifestyle, but also kind of attitudes towards certain things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, I had visited in the Northeast, had visited New York City prior to applying for residency and matching. And I thought it was a fun place, but, you know, I never spent long enough to really know what it's truly like. And I honestly, I love it. I love the diversity. That's something that you don't really get a lot of down south. And so that was one thing that really motivated me to apply to this area. Also, like I said, enjoyed New York City when I came to visit. And so I thought it would be pretty cool to live somewhere very close where it's just like a little, you know, a quick train ride to the city or a drive whenever I want to go. And so, you know, I think that when I have had free time and I'm able to go to the city, it's something that I've definitely enjoyed, going to Broadway shows and things of that nature. And of course, like, whenever someone wants to go on vacation, as far as family and friends are concerned down south, I happen to be kind of a hot spot up here. A lot of people are enjoying coming to visit. So that's also very fun too. So it's been a very fun experience. It's new. I do miss my family, but honestly, I can't necessarily say that I miss the state of Alabama or the South. So that's definitely a good thing, I think.
And of course, it must have been unusual to be Sudanese American in Alabama.
Yes, it is different. A lot of people have no idea where Sudan is, and that's always a very interesting conversation. And we do have a Sudanese community there, but very small. We had a much larger community when I was growing up, but a lot of people have moved away to other states or they've gone back to Sudan. So our community is very small currently. But, you know, again, it's always a very interesting conversation when people are like, oh, you know, I hear your dad has an accent or whatever. Where are you from? And I say Sudan. And they're like, oh, where is that? Is that somewhere in Asia? Or, you know, very rarely do people get it right down south. But here, I find that most people are very familiar, which is pretty cool. I had never experienced that before.
And that's great. So, folks, if you're listening right now, we'd love to have you ask a question of Dr. Hafia El-Tahir. She is a surgeon at Rutgers, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. We're also taking your questions via email, sree@sree.net, sree@sree.net, or you can tweet us at SREE and the hashtag WBAISREE. We have a caller who, or I'm sorry, a listener, Dr. Delta here, who is saying that the president knew, you know, when you said we didn't know this was coming, the president knew and all these folks knew. And we, so what are your thoughts about that, about the virus?
I think that in many ways we failed. I mean, clearly, you know, the number of cases, the number of deaths, not really having a good handle on this, being able to control the spread, is, I think, definitely a failure on our part. And it's very interesting that my family actually overseas, for once, were more concerned about me here in the United States than, you know, ever. I've never had that happen before where they're, you know, constantly, are you okay? Are you safe? We're worried and we're scared. So, you know, I think it's unfortunate that, you know, being a, that we are a first world country, that we weren't able to really, have a good grasp on this and prevent the number of losses, that we've had because of the virus. So hopefully, again, at some point, we're able to, whether it's come up with a vaccination, just people becoming more and more compliant and understanding about, you know, what we need to do in order to protect ourselves and protect others. You know, my hope is that we're able to put this to an end. But unfortunately, I know that there are so many people, even individuals that I know personally, who really do question the validity and, like, I guess the realness of this pandemic, because they haven't really been affected or don't know, they don't personally know of someone, or they're not in the healthcare field, so they don't see it firsthand. So I think that is also one of the biggest issues with a lot of people really making sure that they're doing their part to wear masks, keep their distance, have really good hand hygiene and things of that nature, which is, it's also very unfortunate.
Thank you. We have several callers patiently waiting, so let's go to the callers. You are on WBAI. Tell us your name and where you're calling from, and please ask a question directly. On this show, I have very little patience for folks who talk about hoaxes and spread misinformation. There are plenty of places on the internet. Dr. Eltahir, someone said to me, oh, you're violating the my First Amendment rights. This is not about the First Amendment. This is about my wanting to have one place where we can get accurate, valid information, and that's why we have the show. Let's go to our guest. You're on the air, please.
Yes. Hi, good afternoon. My name is Fidel, and I'm calling from Jersey City. I just want to say it's sad that you have to make that disclaimer on this radio show, but that's where we are today. My question is about nutrition. You know, we don't talk about nutrition at all in this country, and we obviously have failed by not educating people, by having food deserts, by not stressing the importance of exercise and stress reduction and healthy eating and, you know, all of these things that build your immune system, which is your first defense in fighting any kind of disease. So I think that in the broader context of this whole thing, the system has failed us miserably way before this. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that, please.
And thank you, Fidel. Great question. And I appreciate your comment about my comment about the situation we're in. And this is why, in part, you know, Fidel, we've talked on the show for the last 5 months about the failures of the system and other things. But also the fact that one of the reasons why America has done so badly with these results is because of the high rates of obesity, of all these underlying conditions people have. When people compare us to Scandinavia, many of those countries, people lead healthier lifestyles. They have better health care that's free or very inexpensive for people to access. Those are the problems that we have here as well. Thank you so much, Fidel. Let's go to Dr. Eltahir.
Yes, thank you for that question and expressing that concern. And I agree with you 100%. And I feel like, you know, again, we have 100% failed to recognize that this, we really do need to take a very holistic approach to slowing the spread and actually putting an end to this. And you're right. I mean, if you watch the news, if you watch or you read online about this virus, you were constantly hearing about the importance of the six, you know, feet distance that we should keep amongst ourselves. We are constantly hearing about the importance of wearing a mask, which creates a lot of arguments and because of people's personal opinions about it. But rarely do you hear of the talk about how important just overall health and wellness, how important that is and the role that it plays in our immune systems and being able to combat and fight coronavirus or really any virus for that matter. And I think that if we all did our part, number one, to do those things, but number two, to talk about it and educate other people regarding how important that is, that we could see and will see a very big difference. But unfortunately, here in the United States, that's not something that globally we focus on. You know, we have very unhealthy diets, especially down south. You know, and, you know, lots of fried foods and things of that nature. And people, aren't really educated on how important their diet is and exercise. And again, it's not just with coronavirus, but it's with any sort of illness or any sort of virus that we have. I mean, one of the first things that we, get patients to do after surgery, even day one, especially day one after surgery, is to get out of bed and start walking. You know, we want you to get up and start moving because the more you move around, the quicker you heal and the less postoperative complications you have. So we all know it, and in the healthcare field, we do know it, but again, you know, it's not talked about, or taught, especially right now during this pandemic, just how important it is. So I 100% agree.
Folks, you're listening to a conversation with Dr. Hafia El-Tahir, who is a resident and surgeon at Rutgers. She's an ENT surgeon. She works on the head and neck. And my question for you, doctor, before we go to another caller is, and be fair to say you're a younger doctor than most that we've had on the air, that do you feel that younger doctors are more aware of these issues and are kind of just like way young people are more activist in other fields, are younger doctors more activist in your field?
I do believe so. I mean, personally, the young physicians that I do know, this is something that we talk about and a lot of us apply to our personal lives. Many of us work out, we go running, we do our best to stay as active as possible. As a resident, it is very difficult to keep up with the healthiest diet, but a lot of us try our best. You know, when you're working long hours, you know, a lot of times over 80 hours a week, it is very difficult to make sure that you're not eating at 1, 2 a.m., you know, or in when you are snacking in between cases or seeing patients, that you're, you know, eating healthy things and not junk food. But again, I think a lot of us are very mindful of that. And I've had conversations with other co-residents, you know, colleagues about how important our overall health and wellness is. And what I have found is that a lot of those individuals have remained healthy, you know, throughout this pandemic. And a couple of my co-residents who actually did have coronavirus had very, very mild symptoms, but they were already very active and in general lead a very healthy lifestyle. So, you know, I take fault too in not expressing it enough. I talk to my family about it. I talk to my friends, but you know, maybe this is something that even on social media, you know, that I should do my part as well and make sure that I'm emphasizing just how important it is.
Thank you, Doc. Are you on public social media, Instagram or Twitter or any of those?
I do have a Facebook, but I don't use it very often. I very, very rarely use it. So I'm pretty bad about it right now because I'm so busy, but I do plan on, you know, now that I'm becoming a little bit more senior in the residency program, having a little bit more time, and I would like to reconstruct it, to where it's more it's more focused on like overall health, wellness, and also just education about like ENT sort of issues and complications and things like that. So if people have questions, they have somewhere where they can, you know, go and ask or learn. So I'll have to keep you posted on that.
All right. We'll promote your web, your socials when they are ready. Let's go to another caller. You're on the air with Dr. Hafia El-Tahir.
Hello, is this me on now?
Yes, you are. You're on okay. The air on WBAI. Tell us your name and where you're calling from, please.
Yeah, thank you. This is Eric, and I'm on Highway 95 in New Jersey. Doctor, first of all, thank you for your sacrifices so that you can help people. What a fantastic thing to do for a lifetime. As a southern transplant myself, we probably have some shared experiences to show that some of us down south do know global things. Clarification, is your family from southern Sudan or the country of South Sudan?
My family's from North Sudan. So they're actually in Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan. And now that the country has split, it would be considered Sudan, not South Sudan.
I just say that tongue in cheek, just to know that some of us know the difference.
Yes.
Yes. Hey, I wanted to ask, and just a sincere question to help understand all of this, and I appreciate the dialogue, Mr. Shirim, that you present. You know, part of the confusion is first we were told don't wear a mask because you can actually contract corona because you're going to touch your face with the mask, you're going to wear it improperly. And then reverse course, we're supposed to wear a mask. What's the discussion? Was it an honest issue of, you know, or was it just a lack of mask at the beginning? And if the common man reached out and grabbed all the masks, you doctors wouldn't have had it.
Yeah. That's actually a really good question. And in the very beginning, I think that, you know, there was definitely a lack of PPE or personal protective equipment, including masks. And we did find that in a lot of institutions, people, whether they were in the healthcare field and worked at these institutions or they were on the outside, had removed a lot of these, you know, masks, gloves, sani wipes, things like that from the hospital to take home or to give to their families and things like that out of fear and wanting to make sure that they were, you know, themselves protected. So there definitely was a shortage. I know that, at one of the hospitals that I worked at, we even had, a lot of face shields that were like handmade and then donated to the COVID wards in order to make sure that we had something to protect ourselves. So there definitely was a shortage. I think the whole issue with, you know, if you wear the mask, you touch your face, which could be an issue, is that people actually didn't really explain why the whole touching your face could be an issue. The main issue is not that if you touch your cheek, you could get coronavirus. It's, you know, if you're not washing your hands and maintaining good hand hygiene, so you touch a door handle, but then now you've, you know, put your hand in your face, now that increases the risk because the virus lives on surfaces. So it's the same as any other healthcare issue, I guess, that we've dealt with in the past, or just maintaining, you know, good hand hygiene in general. It's just that if you wash your hands, it decreases the chances that you would really contract anything, you know, that is spread in that way. So I think that was maybe not explained well enough. And I heard a lot of people say, like, don't touch your face, don't touch your face. But it's really, don't put your hands in your mouth if you haven't washed your hands. You know, don't touch your lips, you know, don't touch your eyes, things like that if you have not, you know, washed your hands. And so I personally believe that wearing the mask is very important. It was then and it is now. And again, it's not 100%. It doesn't guarantee that you won't get sick, but it does decrease the chances that an individual will get sick.
Thank you, doctor. In terms of the way that this has all gone down, what are things that we could have done differently and that would have helped us not be in this state we're in as a country? Obviously, the Northeast and New Jersey and New York are doing better, but still not good enough.
Yeah, I think educating, if a lot of us had been a little bit more educated, and those that did know had a little bit more knowledge, really worked to spread the knowledge and make people aware, I think that that would have helped a lot. I think, you know, unfortunately this hit and, you know, it was all chaotic and there were so many questions that, you know, went unanswered. And still, I feel like with the virus, there are a lot of questions that are unanswered because we're still researching and learning more and more about it and how it behaves. But I think at the bare minimum, if people all over in the U.S. realize how detrimental this virus could be and how important it was for us to prevent the spread, I think that that would have been, you know, the most important thing to keep a lot of people safe. We failed because, you know, again, we were hit very hard, you know, here in the Northeast and New York and New Jersey. But, you know, I my family in Alabama, my friends down there, they didn't see and experience what we did, even in their hospitals, you know. And so for them, it was a little bit hard to even kind of conceptualize like exactly what's going on and how, you know, how bad it was for us here. So a lot of people didn't follow the precautions. They were traveling. They were still gathering in large groups. And now the numbers are increasing in areas that, you know, they weren't before. And they're kind of getting an idea now of how, you know, important it was then for them to do their part, you know, and they didn't. And now it's like, okay, now what do we do? You know? So I think that we didn't do a good job of making sure that everyone everywhere was informed and educated. And that's the biggest downfall. So many people were just, you know, they weren't affected. So it was hard for them to really understand, you know, how detrimental this was and could be.
Thank you. Before we go to the callers, just a question. If what kind of patients seek you out and how do they find you when you're a resident and a surgeon? How does that work compared to other, you know, like when people who have their own practice or they're part of a hospital? Are you in that situation yet where people can come and consult with you for surgery or other problems? How does that work? Or what stage does that happen?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not really so much in that position right now. What usually happens is for my residency, we cover 5 different hospitals. So depending on which hospital that I'm at during, you know, that month or period of time, that's when I'm, you know, in direct contact with patients. And sometimes I have the privilege of being able to follow up, have close follow up with certain patients, depending on how long I'm at that particular location. But then, you know, the next month I could be at another hospital and I'm taking care of someone completely different or, you know, other patients. And then I no longer see the previous patients that I saw before. So it's kind of hard right now to do that. But once residency is over with and, you know, I'm working somewhere within a practice, then I'll be able to actually accept patients of my own.
All right. Well, we wish you the very best as you get there. We have a caller. You're on the air right now with Dr. Hafia El-Tahir. Please tell us where you're calling from and your name, please.
John from Jersey.
Hi. Welcome.
Hello.
Hey. Hi. I just have a couple of quick questions. I see a lot of people, like especially kids, playing lacrosse by the thousands with no masks, nobody social distancing, all sitting in the field, all in huddles, all running next to each other. And they're opening up sports all over the place. That's one. The question there I'm going to ask in a minute is, and the point I'm getting at is, why are we coming up to have to test to find out that they're sick or they had COVID? So these numbers that we're getting that are spiking are just tests of healthy people that went and got tested, but they had no symptoms. So where's the panic in that? The other thing is, with the Bill Gates and the polio vaccine that he had over his thing, what do you think about mandatory vaccines? And is that ethical? Is that constitutional to have me take put something in my body after people have died from the vaccine they just tested recently? at a 33% rate. You know what I mean? This is what this is coming to, mandatory masks, mandatory vaccines, mandatory chips, you know? So is this the way we really want to go?
Thank you for your question, John. We are going to ask Dr. El-Tahir to answer that.
Okay, so I think the connection went out for a second. So the first question was in regards to children playing
sports and, yeah, sports and lacrosse and things like that. Yeah, I mean, not okay. Just lacrosse, every sport we're seeing starting up, and people are not wearing masks and they're huddling, as he said.
Yeah. And again, that's a very tricky situation because, again, we were just speaking on how important it is to remain active and be healthy and exercise. And here are these young kids who are now, you know, for several months, we're being forced to stay inside and, you know, not meet and gather with their friends or their teammates. And now people are trying to get back out there and kind of, you know, have as much of a normal life as possible. And it's risky. It really is. I don't agree. I do think that, you know, we do need to get back out and start. Like, I go for a run and I run, you know, I have a running buddy and we'll run together and we keep our distance. But I think that, you know, large groups, you know, such as sports teams that are gathering and not wearing masks is definitely not the safest way to go right now. Especially, like I said, we don't have a good handle on the virus. We are seeing that numbers are increasing in different areas, and it's not safe. We don't know how someone's going to be affected by it. There are, you know, instances where young, very healthy people do get it, and they really do suffer and have a lot of complications. Whereas there are some that don't, you know, only have very mild symptoms, and you don't know who's going to be that person that has the mild symptoms and the more severe symptoms. So, you know, I don't have any children. You know, if I did, I definitely would not have my kids out playing sports in large groups like that. And again, not wearing masks. But, you know, I do see and I have heard that that is going on currently.
Thank you, Doc. The other question is, you know, this is the problem that we have, that even somebody who asks a reasonable question about masks is now worried that their chip's going to be planted in everybody. That's what you heard. And worried about Bill Gates. As soon as someone says Bill Gates on a show like this or on social media, they're not saying, oh, there's a man who has helped millions of people fight some of the most hard diseases in the world. Their first question is he putting a vaccine and poisoning all of us? Like, that's the situation we've ended up in. And it's so, so sad that we are in that position. What do you say to people like that? I don't know if you encounter them out in your work, but there are people who worry that we are going to be, you know, put chips in us.
Right. I actually have not had people ask me personally, like in the hospital, or really even family or friends regarding that. I have had people ask me about, you know, what do I think about a vaccine in the future regarding coronavirus, and how do I, you know, feel? Am I going to, you know, accept the vaccination? And honestly, I think, you know, it's just like all other vaccines in the past. They have to go through certain clinical trials, and the safety and efficacy has to be like proven. And at the end of the day, it is, you know, everyone's right to decide whether they want it or not. And I mean, even as we all know today, there are a lot of anti-vaccinators out there, and they don't believe in, you know, receiving any vaccines themselves or vaccinating their children. You know, and I think that that's something that people have to research and figure those things out on your own. And I don't think that just having brief conversations with someone else and someone saying, well, I believe in it or I don't believe it is enough. I think that each person has to take it upon themselves to do their due diligence and really understand and try. And if you don't understand, ask more questions, but make sure that you're getting the information from as many reliable sources as possible. And, you know, again, we all have to kind of make that decision on our own, but I'm quite sure there are going to be several people out there that are going to be completely against it, we're, you know, if we're to come up with a successful or a vaccination that proves that it is effective, then there are going to be people that are going to be all for it.
And therefore, we may not be able to have an effective vaccine as a result.
That is true. But, you know, there is this thing called herd immunity. And so, you know, we have to hope that if there are people that are completely against it, but then this vaccine is actually truly, you know, proves to be effective, that we have enough people who do vaccinate themselves. And hopefully as a result of that, other people will kind of gain protection because of that herd immunity.
So let's hope that happens. And we talked in the last segment about it's not just the right, extreme right, that is upset about vaccines. We had folks like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. who have polluted the conversation around vaccines by raising questions that have resulted in people not trusting vaccine programs anymore. Right. And we had a doctor who was on our air a few weeks ago who runs the rehab wing of her hospital. And she's saying she has young people, old people, middle-aged people, people in every age from 20s to 60s who are in rehab after COVID. They have to learn how to eat again, how to walk again. Why you would risk this because you think you're immune somehow or that you'll get away is just so hard to understand and so frustrating. Folks, you're listening to a conversation with Dr. Hafia El Tahir, and we're very grateful to her for spending part of her Saturday with us, and we're grateful to you for listening. Let's go to our caller. You're on the air. Tell us where you're calling from and your name, please.
Hello?
Yes, caller, you're on the air.
You're on the air. Tell us your name, please.
Hello? Am I on?
Hi, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. This is Debbie from Yonkers. I'm concerned about what is considered safe. I need to visit a relative. She's almost 90, because she has issues, so she needs my help. So I've waited until I could take took the antibody test. I took it once, and they said, they don't call it negative, they say not detected, okay? And when you read the literature, that came, you know, with the aftercare, it also says, oh, it's advisable for you to take another test. I took another test. It's the antibody. It says no, okay, or whatever, the same thing. Is that safe? Can I go and visit her with some confidence that I'm not going to be there causing her a significant problem? Can you answer?
Yes, again, another really good question. You have to keep in mind that the antibody test, and I'm sure you do understand that, but for anyone else listening too, the antibody test does not tell you whether you are currently actively infected with the virus or not. What it is supposed to tell you is, okay, if you've had it before, did you mount a good enough response against it to now you've created antibodies so that if you were to come in contact with it again, that now, you know, your body would be able to fight the virus. So if you want to know whether you're actively infected or you have the virus, then you would actually need to get the antigen test, so the PCR. But if you're worried, if you want to know whether you've had it and if you have some sort of immunity to it, then that's when the antibody test is appropriate. So as far as visiting, you know, loved ones, friends, especially people that are in the geriatric community, you have to just keep in mind that, you know, if they were to become or are to become sick, that their ability to fight coronavirus is going to be a lot less than someone that's, you know, a lot younger. And, you know, what can you do to make sure that you're keeping yourself safe as well as that other individual? So, you know, I'm not going to say not to go and see him or her, but, you know, what is that, seeing that person, what does that consist of? Are you going to be like, you know, sitting very close and things of that nature? Or are you just wanting to kind of fellowship and visit for a little bit, and you will be maintaining a distance, wearing a mask, as well as that other individual? So it's, I would say anytime that we're kind of visiting or we're spending time with other people, we're putting ourselves at risk as well as, that other person. And you just have to kind of keep that in mind that, you know, that it's always possible right now.
Thank you, Doctor. Let's talk for a few minutes. We only have a few minutes left with you, but just to understand what it takes to get to where you are in terms of your, you know, your work, and give you a chance to kind of shout out the kinds of folks that enable the work that you do. You know, when you walk in, if you could walk me through the doors of the hospital, into the hospital, what are the different roles that people have? I mean, doctors are the most prominent, but we have nurses, orderlies, security guards, all of those folks. If you can just kind of give a shout out to those folks, that I think that would be interesting for people to understand what goes on in a hospital.
Yeah. So as a resident, I have a great appreciation for the nurses, the nursing assistants that work in the hospital. Honestly, they are amazing. It's very, you know, interesting that doctors get a lot of credit for taking care of patients and, you know, seeing about them. But honestly, the nurses are the ones that are at the bedside 24/7. They're the ones that are making sure that the patient is eating, that the patient has been bathed and has a clean gown on and clean sheets and things like that. And, you know, a lot, and there's so much to learn from them. So as a resident, you know, I have a profound love and respect for nurses. They work very, very hard. They put themselves on the front line, every day, to make sure that the patients are taken care of. So I have a great respect for them. As far as my attendings that are training me, I have a great respect for them as well and look up to them. You know, I wouldn't be where I am now if it weren't for them. I still have quite a way to go in my training. And, you know, I attribute a lot of the success that I have now to them. And I know that it, you know, as I continue to work and train under them, I'll become the best surgeon that I can possibly be. So, really everyone in the hospital, from the dietitians to the speech pathologists, you know, that work with ENTs, the audiologists that help us with our patients that, you know, have difficulty with hearing, they honestly do everything for us, and we would not be able to do what we do if it weren't for them.
Thank you. What is your message to folks who are listening, who are interested in pursuing careers in medicine, but may not be wanting to be a physician, but all those other roles you play, you described?
I honestly say go for it. As long as, you know, and I say this to medical students too, that come through and they're working with us and they're really trying to figure out, do they want to apply for ENT or, you know, what other specialty they want to apply to. So, you know, I want to apply this message to every area within the medical field. You know, do what you feel passionate about. You know, if you're reading over something and you find that you have joy when you read over it, or you're studying, or you're very intrigued and you want to know more, you know, delve into that. And it doesn't matter how much that position pays or the level of respect you think that you're going to gain from other individuals that see you doing it. You know, if you're doing something for the right reasons, everything else will come. The happiness, the money, the whatever, will all come as long as you're doing it for the right reason, you have a passion for it. There's so many people that go into areas of medicine, especially, you know, into certain specialties as physicians, and they're not happy. And that carries over in so many different ways, how they treat their patients, how they treat other people, how they feel about themselves. And the worst thing you want to do is to have to get up every morning and go to your job and absolutely dread and hate what you do, because you're not going to do a great job at it. So, you know, just whatever that passion is, just go for it. Don't let anyone tell you no. Prove them wrong.
Thank you, Doc. In terms of New Jersey versus New York, do you have a sense of how they've handled it in any way differently. I think they did a lot of work together, didn't they? They cooperated a lot more.
Yeah, that's how I honestly feel. It seems to be about the same. I feel like every time I go out and I'm in public, there are very strict guidelines about distance, about wearing masks. You're not allowed into a certain restaurant or store without a mask on. There are markings on the floor so that people are keeping an appropriate distance. And so I think overall we've done about the same. And in comparison to, you know, Alabama, we've done much better, because I remember at one point my sister even told me, she was like, it's like there's not even a pandemic going on down here. And so, you know, people were out and about, stores were allowing people in without masks. And so, you know, I think we need to continue doing what we're doing and not, you know, become very lax, because I think that's when we're going to start seeing things go in the opposite direction back to where we were, if we're not diligent.
And what is your message for people who are tuning in right now? They're worried about school. They're worried about a reopening. What is your message to them? Talk to the folks in New Jersey and New York first, and then we have listeners around the world, or at least around the country. I can't ask you to talk to the whole world, but at least to around the country.
Yeah, I think that, again, continue to take care of yourself, and be mindful of others. You know, a lot of people, I've heard say that they don't want to wear the mask because it's uncomfortable, or they can't breathe. And, you know, and I understand it's not an easy thing to do, but keep in mind that, you know, whenever you're selfish about the things that only concern you, that you may be putting someone else or someone else's family member at risk. So just, I think we all need to do our part to protect ourselves, and in turn, we'll, you know, be helping to protect others. Exercise, eat well, take the time out to vent or have discussions with families and other family members and friends. Sometimes it's helpful to know that you're not in this alone. There are other people that are, you know, we're all going through it, even if someone isn't speaking about it as much. And as far as school is concerned, I don't really have the answer as far as like reopening and how schools are going to be able to do that. But I do think that as long as you are, you know, asking the appropriate questions about, okay, how are you going to be able to make sure that my child is safe? If you feel that when you send your child to school, or you yourself go to school, that it is a safe environment for you, your child, or others, then go for it. But if it sounds like, you know, there aren't going to be restrictions, or they're not limiting, you know, the number of kids in a classroom, or the space, you know, making sure there's an appropriate space in between individuals, then you have to protect yourself. You have to protect your loved ones. And if that means not going and finding other avenues like Zoom or, you know, WebEx classes, things like that, then I would say, you know, definitely do that. So just try to stay as safe as possible.
Excellent advice. And we'll end on that. Thank you so much, Dr. Hafia El-Tahir. We wish you the very best and good luck with your residency. And we can't wait to see where you land next.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sri. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I think you gave me a battlefield promotion there to doctor. My mom would be very, very, very happy. Thank you, Dr. El-Tahir. Tune in next Saturday, everybody, noon to 2, for another edition of Coping with COVID-19. I'm your host, Sri Srinivasan. Thanks for listening. I'm doing other shows on my Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. Srinet is my name on YouTube. Thanks for your feedback via sri@sri.net. And please stay safe out there, folks. If you have to go out, please wear a mask. If you can still social distance, please, please do that. And we'll see you next week. We're going to leave you with Empire State of Mind, the classic Jay-Z and Alicia Keys song about the city we all know and love. Thanks for listening to our show and supporting WBAI. Progressive, listener-supported radio needs your support. See you next week. Bye-bye. Side Knicks and Nets give me high five. I'll be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely leave from. Here.
game. Right, I made the Yankee hat more famous than the Yankee King. You should know I bleed blue, but I ain't a crypto. But I got a gang of bodies walking with my click though. Welcome to the melting pot, corners where we selling rock. Africa been by the step, home of the hip-hop. Yellow cap, gypsy cap, dollar cap, holla back. For foreigners, it ain't fair, they act like they forgot how to act. 8 million stories out there in the naked city. It's a pity half of y'all won't make it. Me, I got a plug special ed, I got it made. If Jesus paying LeBron, I'm paying Dwayne Wade. Three dice CeeLo, three card Marley. Labor Day parade, rest in peace Bob Marley. Statue of Liberty, long live the World Trade, long live the King. Yo, I'm from the Empire State. That's
this is Eric Anderson.
This is Rosie Perez.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is LL Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
Hello, I'm Isaac Ferguson. I'm inviting you to tune in on Saturday at 4 to 6 p.m. for Caribbean Voices and Beyond, when we will bring you news, views, and important issues affecting the Caribbean community in particular and the immigrant community in general. Tune in 4 to 6 p.m. to Caribbean Voices and Beyond on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the Internet.
Right next to the Narrow, but I'll
traveling
be
around New York City, one sees many people wearing masks, but others running or on bikes or just walking down the street aren't wearing them. Some not wearing masks try to avoid people. They walk around mask wearers, and still others wearing masks have them down below their noses. And, of course, New York City is nothing like Ocean City, where thousands without masks crowd boardwalks and beaches. But here in New York City, those not wearing masks or wearing masks improperly are worrisome. Can't think they don't care, but cavalier attitudes regarding masks put some of us on edge. Maybe they didn't get the message from New York officials that masks are to protect others. Activist Ajamu Baraka tweets, self-indulgent narcissism equals USA. Governor Andrew Cuomo says there's no legitimate rational explanation.
Well, I don't like the way it looks. You know what? Paint something on the mask, right? Get a new color. You know, you can get a designer mask. It's such a, the opposition is so trivial and nonsensical relative to the risk. You could get sick. You could make somebody else sick. Even if you think you're a Superman or Superwoman, you could bring the virus home and get someone sick and it winds up killing them.
Here at WBAI, you can get one of those interesting face masks. We've created masks which show the value of our radio station, WBAI, and show that we value others. The masks are 100% cotton. They're available in white or black. For a contribution of $35, it gets you a WBAI face mask with our logo and the saying, keep free speech radio alive. Please call 516-620-3602 and ask for a WBAI face mask for a contribution of $35, 516-620-3602, or go to the WBAI donation website, give2wbai.org, and order a WBAI logo face mask. And you'll help us pay for this listener-sponsored free speech radio station, WBAI New York. Thank you for your support.
Es una gran oportunidad para hacer que nuestras voces se oigan.
Este año tenemos el poder de determinar el futuro de nuestra ciudad, no solo para los próximos 4 años, sino los próximos 10, a través de ser contado en el censo. El censo se trata del poder del dinero y del respeto para nuestras comunidades. Si nuestra ciudad es subcontada, corremos el riesgo de ser subrepresentados, especialmente en la comunidad de color. En el 2010, solo el 62% de neoyorquinos respondieron al censo, con las tasas de respuestas más bajas en comunidades negras y marrones. En 2020 no podemos dejar que esto pase de nuevo. Si quieres resistir este status quo y desafío,